I have done very few foolish things in my life, but there is one that sticks out in my mind, and I'm glad that I'm alive today to talk about it. Because right before we left Illinois to move to New Jersey, we were cleaning up the brush that had accumulated around our property and also our garden. We had a beautiful garden at that time, and the people that bought our house said they did not want the garden, so they wanted me to plow it under. But we had too much growth to plow under, so I piled it all together, the brush and so on, in a big pile in the middle of the tilled garden. And since in our particular community in which we lived, we were allowed to burn our leaves in the streets in the fall. We had brick-lined streets, and we were allowed to pile our leaves up there and torch them. So I figured that if we could burn a little brush in the middle of a tilled garden. So I piled it up high, but it was kind of green, and I decided I needed something extra to get that fire started. I went to my garage, and I thought I had some kerosene in my garage, and I thought I would use that, but all I had was a gallon of gasoline. Now, I know that gasoline is very volatile, especially gasoline vapors, but I thought that since we were outside with plenty of space, that I had nothing to fear. So I poured gasoline on this pile. I moved the gas can about 50 feet away and then came back to light the pile. I lit one match, threw it into the pile, and ran. Now, I was perhaps about 20 feet from the pile when, boom, flame shot about 50 feet into the air, as high as the highest tree. The force of the explosion knocked me off my feet, sending me flying through the air and landing head first in the grass. It knocked the breath right out of me. Now, by the time I was able to stand again, I watched a ring of fire descend from the cloud, from the sky, and start my lawn on fire. Fortunately, Susan and our next door neighbor were standing nearby, and after they stopped laughing, they helped to beat out the burning grass. And by the time the fire department arrived, the pile of brush had been reduced to a little flickering flame. But I learned my lesson that day, and that is gasoline can be explosive and very, very dangerous. However, whenever I drive, there are a great number of explosions in my car. Now, I'm not talking about conversations with my wife, but inside my internal combustion engine that powers my vehicles are thousands of little explosions. Gasoline, vapor, and air mixed together in the right ratio, injected into the cylinders of the engine at the right time, then compressed, and at the height of compression, the electronic ignition sends a spark to the plugs, and boom, an explosion occurs. An explosion in a controlled environment that drives the pistons down, the pistons connected to the crankshaft, which causes it to rotate, the crankshaft connected to the transmission, which is connected to the transaxle, which is connected to my front wheels, which calls them to turn, and I am propelled down the road, all by a series of tiny explosions. In that internal combustion engine under the hood of my car. So gasoline, even an explosion of gasoline, when under control and channeled in the right way, can be beneficial and powerful. Now, you and I were not made to run on gasoline, but we were made to run on, besides other fuels, the fuel of emotions. Most of us run on our feelings. Many people run on love. Now, I know that some Christians teach that love is more than a feeling, and I do teach that as well, that it is a commitment to give of themselves for the benefit of another, but that we should love our spouses whether we feel like it or not. And I would agree. But agape love also includes feelings. The warm fuzzies, the racing heart, the sweaty palms, the rush when we are in the presence of the one we love. The kind, affectionate feelings that we have for our spouse that spurs us on to do things for them. Yes, when the going gets tough and the warm fuzzies are now cold fizzles, yes, at that time we must dig deep and run on our commitment. But for the most part, we do what we do for our spouses or loved ones because of the good feelings that exist between us. We run on the warm, fuzzy fuel of love. But my friends, we also run on the fuel of anger. That is, if we can keep it under control and channeled in the right direction. It needs to be properly managed. You notice what Paul says again in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 26, where he commands us, be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your wrath, nor give place to the devil. We are commanded to be angry. There are times, as we saw last week, there are times when anger is the appropriate response. Anger in and of itself is neutral. That is, it's neither good nor bad. It's possible for you and I to be angry and not to sin. Jesus, the Son of God, he expressed anger on numerous occasions. When he saw the injustices in this world, when he saw people being abused, or when his Father's name was insulted, he was angry and he did so without sin. So it's possible for you and I to be angry and not sin, if we manage it properly, that is, if we do not let the sun go down on your wrath. But the kind of anger that is very dangerous for you and I is suppressed anger, for when we stuff it, it doesn't go away. We may think it has, and many times people who have suppressed their anger think that they're really not angry at all. It's apparent to everybody else around them that they're angry, but if you were to ask them, what are you angry about, their reply would be, oh, I'm not angry. What do you mean I'm angry? There's nothing wrong. I'm not upset. They have suppressed their anger. But suppressed anger becomes the seedbed in which other forms of anger grow. Bitterness, wrath, clamor or broiling or fighting, evil speaking, slander, malice. And it is the crack that gives our adversary an opportunity to set up base of operation in our lives and do his work from the inside out. I have met in my pastoral career people who are so angry, are bitter or upset with things in life, and that anger is so deep-seated within them that it controls them and colors their thinking. They look at all of life through angry eyes and a cynical attitude. And I've sensed within my own spirit that what I'm encountering is more than human anger gone amok, but that there are demonic forces at work in their lives. Now in the future, after we look at other ways that our adversary can get his foot in the door of our lives, we're going to consider the signs of demonic activity. How can we tell if there is a demonic incitement in the anger or if this is merely a human expression of it? And then we're going to consider what we can do if we detect demonic infiltration in ourselves and others. For the remedy is the same for each. But this morning, I want to answer the question I raised at the end of last week's message, and that is, how do we manage anger in the proper way so that our adversary does not have a chance to set up a base of operation in us? How do we handle this volatile fuel so that we do not self-destruct nor destroy the people around us? Well, as I understand anger, there are five ways in which you and I can manage anger. Now, not all five ways are beneficial or good. In fact, three of them play right into the hand of our adversaries. there are two, I think, that are good ways of handling it. The first one being that of suppressing it. We looked at that a little bit. That is, stuff it. Let it simmer underneath and underground. Remember the case study of Saul? Saul, after David defeated Goliath, it says that he took him that day and would not let him go home to his father's house anymore. David became not only Saul's music therapist who played his harp when the distressing spirit from the Lord came upon him and drove him to temporary insanity, but he also became an officer in Saul's army and part of Saul's bodyguard, his inner core. 1 Samuel 18, verse 5 reveals, so David went out wherever Saul sent him and behaved wisely. And Saul set him over the men of war, and he was accepted in the sight of all the people, and also in the sight of Saul's servants. Now it happened that as they were coming home, when David was returning from the slaughter of the Philistines, that the women had come out of all the cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines, with joy, and with musical instruments. So the women sang as they danced and said, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. Then Saul was very angry, and the saying displeased him, and he said, they have ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed only thousands. Now what more can he have but the kingdom? So Saul eyed David from that day forward. Saul eyed David. He was jealous. David was given more credit, more accolades for the victories that he had received. And he became very angry, but instead of managing his anger properly, he eyed David from that day forward. He suppressed it. Everything David did from that point on, Saul viewed through bitter, angry eyes and assigned evil motives to David that were not true. On numerous occasions, he tried unsuccessfully to kill David. He tried a few times to pin him against the wall with a spear. And when David inquired about marrying Saul's oldest daughter, Merab, Saul consented to give her to him as a wife on one condition. He had to be valiant for me and fight the Lord's battle. For Saul thought, let not my hand be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him. And so he tried to get rid of David by putting him in harm's way. But David prevailed. Saul's suppressed anger surfaced when he realized that his son Jonathan had made a pact with David and was sheltering him. 1 Samuel 20, verse 30 records, then Saul's anger was aroused against Jonathan, and he said to him, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman, do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, you shall not be established, nor your kingdom. Now, therefore, send and bring him to me, for he shall surely die. And Jonathan answered Saul, his father, and said to him, why should he be killed? What has he done? Then Saul cast a spear at him to kill him, by which Jonathan knew that it was determined by his father to kill David. Now from that day forward, Saul, in anger, went after David, hunting him down like one would hunt a wild animal. In fact, 1 Samuel 23, verse 14 says that Saul sought him every day, but God did not deliver him into his hands. And Saul died a very angry man. He had suppressed his anger, and that anger ate away at him and gave Satan an opportunity to work in him. Now, as we saw in detail last week, suppressed anger can cause all kinds of physical, emotional, and even spiritual problems, including opening up our lives to demonic activity. So it's not a good idea to stuff it. Well, then perhaps we should just vent it, explode, let off the steam. I know many modern psychologists and psychiatrists advocate some form of ventilation of anger. If you are angry, they would say, you need to find some way of letting off steam. So go ahead, punch the pillow, beat on the couch or on the chair, put a picture of your boss on the wall and throw darts at it. Go into your room, close the door, and scream at the top of your lungs at the world. Or perhaps some less drastic measures, like put on your jogging shoes and go out and run a couple of miles, or ride on that stationary bike until the wheels fall off, or take that punching bag that you have and give it a couple good punches. Some way to let out the steam. Now, I see nothing biblically wrong with this non-threatening form of ventilation, but may I say it's only a temporary solution that relieves the pressure for the moment, certainly not a long-term solution. However, there is a form of ventilation that's extremely dangerous and plays right into the hands of our adversary, and that is when we ventilate our anger against another in a threatening way. We lose our temper, we blow up, and the ventilation may come in the form of verbal berating and abuse. We give the other person a piece of our minds that we can ill afford to lose. But listen to what Solomon says in Proverbs 29, verse 11. He says, a fool vents his feelings, but a wise man holds them back. Now, it looks like he's saying we should suppress. I like the way the NIV translates the verse. It says, a fool gives full vent to his anger, but a wise man keeps himself under control. See, full of anger, we say things we shouldn't say, that perhaps later on we wish we would not have said. Hurtful, hateful remarks that cut the other person to shreds. We may get everything off of our chest, but in the process, we may have destroyed another or deeply damaged the relationship. James says of the tongue that no man can tame the tongue. It is an unruly evil full of deadly poison. With it we bless our God and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in the similitude of God. Our mouths are full of deadly poison. Now, a wise man, on the other hand, keeps his temper under control. He waits until the emotions of the moment subside so that he can think rationally about what he's going to say, and then he speaks. For James says, so then, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath, for the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God. The wrath of man doesn't produce positive results. It has to be under control. We need to be swift to hear, slow to speak, and slow to get angry. But venting one's anger can take a more destructive form, and it can become physical with striking or hitting or beating up another, even can lead to murder. I wish child abuse or wife abuse or elderly abuse or even husband abuse was something that we found only out in the world among people who do not know the Lord. But my friends, that's not the case. I have known cases of believers who in a fit of rage have struck their wives or have beaten their children, and in some cases have even used the Bible as their justification for the physical abuse. They are clearly out of control with their temper, and the adversary has used that temper to destroy their homes, to scar their children, to turn their children away from God, and even to destroy the person's reputation and their witness to the world. Now you might be thinking to yourself, I just can't help myself. A pastor, I have such a violent temper. My anger is like an erupting volcano. It rumbles under the surface, and then it pours out. The truth is, we can control ourselves. It's amazing what you can do. I mean, suppose you're having a fight with your spouse and someone calls you on the phone. How would you answer the phone? Would you say, hello? Or would you say, hello? You'd be amazed how quickly you can bring your anger under control. We can control our anger if we want. It's a command of Scripture. And for the child of God, who is the person of the Spirit of God, living inside of him with all of his power, with all of his might, my friends, it's definitely possible for us to control our anger. So ventilation is not the right way to channel one's anger. Blowing up by relieving your stress, but the shrapnel causes all kinds of pain in others, and it plays into the hand of the enemy who is out to destroy. So suppressing it is not the answer, but neither is ventilating it. Then perhaps the way to channel my anger is to suppress it for a time and then kind of let it out in non-aggressive, passive ways. This is the slow leak of the passive aggressive. The slow leak of the passive aggressive. A passive-aggressive person will not get outwardly mad or angry. They know that they're upset or mad, but it's too risky for them to express it directly to another person. So they find indirect ways to kind of leak it out, to leak out their anger in ways that kind of frustrate others through subtle sabotage. Instead of becoming angry and vocal, they become silent, knowing that the silence really bugs that other person. Or, if they do not get their own way, they sulk and they pout. Or if they are upset with you, they work slower than normal. It is as if they go into slow motion and drag out the work. Or they put it off altogether and they procrastinate, knowing that it really gums up everything. Or perhaps they will talk about another behind their back to others, but will not confront them face to face. Or they refuse to do a favor for another, knowing that this will really irritate them. It is a passive way of expressing anger. They don't blow up, they don't clam up totally, but they kind of slowly let their anger leak out and poison the relationship or get even with the object of their anger. Over the years, I've observed and have been around and even worked with some passive-aggressive people. When I worked at the paper mill years ago during my college days, I worked alongside a man who was clearly angry. He was angry at life. He was angry at the boss. He was angry at the company for which he worked. He was angry with his wife, who he said loved Barry Manilow more than him. He was angry at everything in life. But he never voiced his anger to those with whom he was upset. He only shared it with me. And he did only the minimum required to keep his job. And he would drag his feet when given more work to do than he thought was in his contract, his union contract, or in his job description. His passive-aggressive ways meant that I never knew where I stood with him. For he was always nice to my face, but who knows what he was saying about me behind my back. And on occasion, he did things that sabotaged my work, making it harder for me to do what the boss had ordered. His passive aggressiveness or slow leak was the way that he was handling his anger, and it's not the way to handle it. Then what is? How can we be angry and not sin? How can we channel anger so it does not become a foothold for our adversary to set up operation in us? Well, one way is to redirect the anger towards a solution. Redirect your anger towards a solution. Anger has to be redirected away from the person, even away from the problem, and directed towards a solution. You and I can either be problem-oriented or solution-oriented. problem-oriented or solution-oriented. You can tell a problem-oriented person because that is all they like to talk about, their problems. They keep going over and over again in their minds and with you the painful experiences that they've had in hopes that others will feel sorry for them. They're looking for someone to take the blame, someone that they can point to as the problem so as to take the attention off themselves. They're not looking for a solution, but rather for sympathy. But the key to handling the anger that you might be feeling over the wrongs that you've experienced is to redirect that anger towards finding a solution. Jesus Christ in John chapter 2, when we saw that last week, when he confronted the money changers in the temple, he was angry. He was angry with what was going on, with how they made the house of God a house of merchandise. And so he sized up the situation, and in anger he did something about it. He found a solution in the form of a whip, which he used to drive the money changers from that temple. His anger was redirected to solving the problem, not stewing in it. Now let's face it, sometimes it takes someone to get mad, someone to get upset, or to anger before they are moved to action. It takes a tragedy, perhaps a child senselessly killed by a drunk driver, for people in a community to get mad and angry and finally do something to try to solve that problem. Most of the time, we are happy with the status quo. And then we see something that really upsets us, and that anger fuels our efforts to find a solution. But redirecting anger or being assertive does not mean that we must be harsh with people, nor is it meant to harm them. Instead, it's addressing concerns about self-worth, needs, and convictions in such a way that the doors are kept open for further dialogue and expressions of love. For an example, an overworked church worker, and it seems to be the tendency of the church or any charitable organizations, that when they find a willing worker, they load them up to capacity. But an overworked church worker who's frustrated and angry about the load they are carrying can blow up, or they might even suppress that anger, develop a very bad attitude, or they might suppress it and then leak it out slowly through doing a poor job or through dragging their feet so that the work of ministry grinds to almost a halt. Or they can be assertive by politely but firmly saying no to a request to do even more. A parent who's upset with a child's behavior can handle their anger by setting up and enforcing family guidelines without debating or condescending to the child's level. Frankly, many parents are angry at their children and at life because they have allowed their children to run the family and call the shots instead of asserting themselves that they are the parents and that they make the rules in the household. But asserting oneself must be done in love. But it's important to take a stand in one's relationship to set boundaries, to direct one's anger at a solution rather than at the person. So redirecting the anger to find a solution, that's one way to properly handle the anger so that it does not become a foothold for Satan in our lives. But there's one more, and that is sometimes we just have to give it over to God. Give it over to God. Concerning Jesus Christ, Peter observes this. He says, "For to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that we should follow his steps, who committed no sin, nor was deceit found in his mouth, who, when he was reviled, did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously. When they hurled their insults at Jesus, he did not retaliate. He did not hurl back at them and get into a war of words. When he suffered on the cross, he made no threats. He didn't say to them, "You'll burn in hell for this. You just wait. One day you'll have to stand before me and I will be your judge and you will pay dearly." But what did he say? He said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they're doing." Instead of retaliating and threatening, he committed himself to him who judges righteously. That is, he put the whole matter into God's hands. He gave it over to God. Now you might be thinking, okay, that was Jesus Christ. He was God in the flesh. He was sinless. But what about a sinful human being like me? I mean, how can I do this? Well, consider then the experience of David. We looked a little bit earlier about David and Saul, but David spent years of his life running from Saul, who was out to kill him. He had every right to be upset, to be angry, to be frustrated, and to take matters in his own hands and even kill Saul before he killed him. But when it appeared that God in the cave of En-Gedi had delivered Saul into David's hands, David arose, and it says in 1 Samuel 24 that he secretly cut off the corner of Saul's robe. That's how close they were. He was able to take his knife and just cut off and snip off a corner of his robe as they were in that cave together. But 1 Samuel 24 verse 5 says, "Now it happened afterwards that David's heart troubled him because he had cut Saul's robe. And he said to his men, 'The Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, to stretch out my hand against him, seeing he is the anointed of the Lord.'" Now, why would David spare Saul's life? I mean, this man is out to kill him, and if the tables were turned, Saul would have had no qualms at all of driving a spear through David. How does David handle his anger and refuse revenge? Well, he gives us this rationale as to why he did not kill Saul in verse 12. Where David says, "Let the Lord judge between you and me, and let the Lord avenge me on you, but my hand shall not be against you." David gave the matter over to God and entrusted his life into God's care. He goes on to say, "Therefore, let the Lord be judge, and judge between you and me, and see him plead my case, and deliver me out of your hands." David committed the situation to God, for God to handle. Frankly, my friends, there are many times that we just have to give our anger over to God. Dropping our anger means that we accept our inability to completely to control the circumstances, and we recognize our personal limitations. That this is one situation that we cannot solve or change. And so we choose to accept the person or the situation as it is, and we give the emotional anger that we're feeling over to God. We cast our anxiety, we cast our care, we cast whatever is bothering upon us, and we cast it upon the Lord because he cares for us. We choose to forgive the other person. We let go of the offense, and God fills our hearts with peace. We follow the words of Paul, who wrote in Romans chapter 12. He says, "Repay no one evil for evil. Have regard for good things in the sight of all men. If it's possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. Beloved, do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath. For it is written, 'Vengeance is mine. I will repay,' says the Lord." We're giving place to wrath. That is, we're giving wrath a place. We're giving it over to God for him to handle. We hand it over to him because God has promised, "Vengeance is mine. I will repay. God will take care of this. Now, may I warn us all here, though, our adversary is also known in Scripture as the accuser of the brethren, who not only accuses us constantly before the Father in heaven over the sins that we've done, but he's also constantly reminds us of the offenses that others have done against us. So, my friends, if you decide that the solution to the situation is not to assert yourself, but instead to give the person or situation over God for him to work, to place it in God's hand, please be warned that this is probably not a one-shot deal, but that you're going to probably have to hand it over to God daily, sometimes hourly, as Satan continues to bring to your remembrance the hurt, the pain that is fuels your anger. You need to hang it over to God. But you might be saying to yourself, I can't drop it. I can't forgive them for what they did to me, for how they hurt me and my family. Well, we have to, for our own sake, to forgive, for as we're going to see, Lord willing, after Easter, an unwillingness to forgive is another way in which Satan can gain a foothold in our lives, through an unwillingness to forgive. So, my friends, are you angry this morning? What is eating your lunch? But more importantly, how are you managing your anger? You got to do something with it. Suppressed anger provides the base of operation for our adversary to work in our lives to destroy us, our relationships, our Christian witness, and effectiveness. So it's not wise to stuff it. But the anger has to come out somehow. We can blow up or allow it to slowly leak out through passive means, but both of these only inflame more anger, not diminishing it. Or we can choose to redirect our anger towards a solution, to be assertive in setting our boundaries, to solve the problem causing the angry response. Or we can choose in those situations that are beyond our control, things we cannot change or solve, we can choose like Jesus and like David to give our anger over to God, to cast the care upon him, to put the situation in his hands, to forgive and accept others, and to leave it in God's hands and leave with God's peace. My friends, the choice is ours. But how? How are we going to manage our anger?